Hello and welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey-Karras and I'm here with Amanda Hayes. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Anna. Hello, everyone.
And this week we've been reading All Our Worldly Goods. I just forgot the title. All Our Worldly Goods by Irene Nemirovsky, translated by Sandra Smith. But first, book news, and we've now got the Booker Prize.
Drum roll.
The long list has been announced. And even though I'm still grumpy with the Booker after they did the tied result last year, it's still the most prestigious book prize, certainly in the UK, and now covers American authors as well. So in the English speaking world. And so it's still one that's really interesting to watch. So let's go through quickly the long list. So the long list is what they call the Booker's Dozen, which is 13 books.
A baker's dozen.
So a baker's dozen or Booker's Dozen. So of those 13, Amanda, I had read two.
Yes, well, you're one up on me, Anna, because I'd only read one.
Annie and I joke about how often these lists come out and we've hardly read any of the books, but I think this is one of my lowest.
But I think, Anna, and I'm sure you'll go on to say this, I think 8 of them are debut authors, so that lets us off the hook a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. So when you see these names that you think, how come I've never heard of these authors, that would be the reason. So yes, that has been one of the striking things about the list. 8 of them are debut authors, 9 of the 13 are women, it's got some really good diversity in the list. So the first one is The New Wilderness by Diane Cook, and that's a debut book. She's an American author and it sounds a bit dystopic, but really interesting. I had not heard of it before. I think it's just come out or just coming out. And the next one is This Mournable Body by Tsitsi Dangaremba. And this is a sequel to a book she wrote 30 years ago called Nervous Conditions. And it's set in Harare, Zimbabwe. And it sounds amazing.
Yes, I've put a star by that one. Yeah. I really want to read it.
So the only question is whether we should read Nervous Conditions as well, because I think it's the same character, but it follows her and then it's years and years later. And I assume you can read it really as a standalone, but whether you get more out of it.
More depth.
Reading the first one. But the author, Tsitsi Dangaremba, has just been arrested in Zimbabwe for protesting against corruption.
Oh, is that right?
And this was 2 days ago, I believe, and she's just been released on bail. But I gather that there is some political unrest there, and she's been active in speaking out against, I think they've been arresting journalists and so on. So certainly some issues that possibly she explores in the novel as well. The next one is Burnt Sugar by Avni Doshi, and this is another debut novel set in India, and it's a mother and daughter story, and I think the mother was quite wild in her youth and lived on an ashram and took her daughter around but wasn't the most attentive parent, and then it reverses in as she gets older, her daughter then needs to take care of her and overcome some resentment at her own upbringing. And it's been described as a good book for fans of Jenny Offal and Deborah Levy's Hot Milk and Diana Evans' Ordinary People, which sounds... That's hooked me in.
Yeah, me too. That's got a little star by it on my list.
Another star, and it's got the most incredible cover and was released in India and has only just been released in the UK, and apparently there's been a lot of hype around it because it was a big hit in India.
Oh,
so
great.
That should be coming our way soon, hopefully. Then Who They Was by Gabrielle Krause, and that's another debut novel, and this is set in London in the streets and sounds like quite a gritty book that gives you a side of London you don't normally read about in literature, which really intrigues me. So that's Who They Was. Then The Mirror and the Light by Hilary Mantel. So not a surprise that it's on the long list. This is the third in the Thomas Cromwell trilogy. Annie and I did it on the podcast. Mixed feelings. I think it started off so strongly and her writing is almost unmatched, and then it sagged a bit in the middle for me because it was so factual, and then the ending, the last 100 pages just broke me. So it's almost a book that you could give it the Booker for the last 100 pages, and I think if you read the other two books, you feel like you've just been on this, you've had this experience. It's quite amazing. Mm. But on the other hand, I couldn't say that I loved it overall, and it was a slog in the middle.
Right,
it's a 900-page book. Having said that, it's better than The Testaments, which won for Margaret Atwood last year. So I think if they're giving it to authors just because they really love the author.
Yeah, although she has won it twice before.
Yes, and that's a reason for or against in a way, because she'd be the first person to win it three times, which, you know, maybe they'd. That would be fun, but on the other hand, she doesn't need the win.
No.
You know, she doesn't need the profile, but
hopefully they won't do a joint award this year.
Let's just say no more about that. No, so that wasn't a surprise to see it on the long list. I'll be really interested to see if it gets shortlisted. Mm. Then A Pyragon by Colin McCann. So he's quite an established author. I haven't read his books, but I've always heard very good things about his work, and he's been described as masterful. And this is a story about a friendship between a Palestinian father and an Israeli father, because both of their children die. So even though they're sort of on opposing sides of a conflict, they form this friendship, and it's inspired by a real life story that Colin McCann encountered and decided to write about it. So it's quite interesting. It doesn't immediately appeal to me, but I'm sure that it would be a really interesting book. The Shadow King by Maza Mengiste, set in Ethiopia, where the author was born, and set during Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia. So that really interests me.
Yeah.
And again, it has a fabulous cover. So The Shadow King is on my radar. Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid. And this has been a real it book of 2020. Everybody's been reading it. It's been described, I think, as a great book club book, very accessible, but lots of issues. And it's that one that has the premise that I'm sure all our listeners have heard about, but the premise is a black babysitter is called in to babysit late at night when she's sort of dressed up to go out, but she does it as a favour and takes this young white girl to the supermarket, and while she's there she's accused of kidnapping her, and that's the sort of the jumping off point. And then it develops into a story about her friendship or the relationship that she has with her employer, who's the mother of this girl who's white. And I think it explores that idea of white privilege. Yeah. And I was listening to the High Low podcast, and they were talking about it on that podcast. I think they both, Pandora Sykes and Dolly Alderton, both really liked it, but said it was an uncomfortable read as a white woman, which is not a bad thing.
No.
So that I have heard mixed reviews, but I think it sounds like a really good
book. It's very topical anyway,
isn't
it?
A really good topical book and a good book club read for those who are looking for a book club pick. So again, interesting to see it on the long list. And then Real Life by Brandon Taylor. This is a coming of age story by a black queer author, American, and this is a coming of age story set in the States. I've forgotten which state, but that's Real Life. Redhead by the Side of the Road by Anne Tyler.
Yes, and what did we do? Clock Dance.
We were a bit
Underwhelmed,
yes, weren't we? And this one, I've heard Matthew Sharapa loved it, and he said a lot of people won't think that there's much to it because she writes so effortlessly.
Yep.
But he said that there is a really good character study in this book. I don't know. I haven't heard rave reviews other than that. Shuggie Bain, Douglas Stewart. And this is another debut about a young boy and an alcoholic mother set in working class Glasgow.
Oh, how depressing.
And I feel a bit sad just reading the blurb. Yeah. But Damien Barr has raved about
this.
Has he? So,
okay.
And the author sounds amazing. So I'm intrigued, but I would really have to psych myself.
Yes, that's how I feel.
But it does sound amazing. I feel like that. I hope it gets onto the shortlist, because that's one that I do want to sort of find out a bit more about. Love and Other Thought Experiments by Sophie Ward. So this, again, a debut novel, and this has been described as a philosophical novel with, as it says on the tin, thought experiments. And Eric from Lonesome Reader has raved about this book and said he was so excited that it's on the list. So I'm very intrigued.
That sounds good.
Mm. And then finally, How Much of These Hills is Gold by C. Pam Zhang, which we did on the podcast.
Yay, one that I've read.
And I was excited to see that on the list because I think it is worthy of being on the list. Her writing is really exquisite, especially for a debut, and it is that reimagining of the Western and just with a great different perspective. So I really enjoyed that book. I thought that was, very pleasing to see that on the list. And in sort of booker, I wouldn't even say gossip, but in terms of the response to this long list, which is always interesting as well, the Times wrote an article and the headline was Booker Prize 2020 Long List, Where Are the New Male Hotshot Novelists? Which I thought was so funny. And I think, I mean, the point is, I suppose they have to have an angle. You can't just publish the long list. You have to have a take on it. And in a sense, they're being a bit provocative, just suggesting that there's been a change to more women having success as authors and also authors of colour who they barely mention. So when they say there are no young male novelists, they really mean white male novelists, but they're sort of suggesting, you know, that if there's more diversity, this comes at the expense of white men, which I think is a false binary. I don't think that's actually the case. And if you look at the Booker winners in the past 10 years, 5 out of the 10 or 11 since there's been the tie have been men. So it doesn't really reflect in the prize winning. Mm. But they say things like the young male novelist is not quite extinct. That's certainly not as ubiquitous as he used to be. So they're talking about, you know, that old guard of – well, they're old now, but they weren't obviously at the time. But the Ian McEwan, Martin Amis, Paul Auster, Julian Barnes – I would add Peter Carey, who were all actually friends as well. They were contemporaries and they would hang – and Christopher Hitchens was in that sort of cohort, and they were – when obviously in their day – hot, young, white, male novelists. And I suppose they're just saying who are the next –
generation.
You know, what's the next generation? And the fact is it might look a bit different.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Know, this is the next generation.
That's
differently
right.
composed and more reflective of modern society.
I think so. Mm. So there's not really any cause for alarm. But having said that, if Martin Amis had a son who could write, I would read it. You know, I'm very happy to read. And I mean, he, in his day, I think his later work wasn't as good, was virtuosic and incredible to read. But yeah, who's writing like that now? It could be these 13 authors on the long list. So as a reader, I'm just interested in who's writing that work that kind of takes your breath away or makes you think or is just a joy to read or gets you talking, like the Kylie Reid book or whatever it might be. So that was interesting. And now on to our book of the week. So we've been reading All Our Worldly Goods by Irene Nemirovsky, translated from the French by Sandra Smith. And this ties in with Women in Translation Month. Mm. So we're now into August, hard to believe, and August is Women in Translation Month. So this was started by Maytel Radzinski, and you can follow Maytel on Twitter and Instagram. So she goes under @read_wit, W-I-T, and on Instagram she's @readwit, so R-E-A-D-W-I-T, for inspiration and ideas and updates. And I saw on her Instagram recently she actually had highlighted and posted pictures of all these women authors around the world who are currently not translated into English. Mm. And that always gives me FOMO. Because
we can't access them.
We can't, yeah. Mm. Well,
although we did talk about this before, Anna, and about what a complicated market the translation market is, because it costs so much more to bring a book through translation to publication. And so it kind of puts some of the publishers in a bit of a risk-averse position. They only want to translate something they think is going to be a sure bet.
Yeah.
So it means that we do miss out on some of the more, I guess, cutting edge or things that are pushing boundaries.
I think we must be missing a lot, but we can only, you know, we can only read so much, can't we? So we encourage all of you to read a woman, you know, a book by a woman in translation in August or any time of the year. That's what that's what I always say. And we just did The Breasts and Eggs by Miyako Kawakami. I think we've done a couple this year actually by women.
We have.
My mind's gone blank now as to who they were. Oh, we did the Kyung Suk Shin, the girl who wrote Loneliness.
The girl who wrote Loneliness, yes.
So Irene Nemirovsky was Ukrainian. She was born in 1903 and she moved to France to escape the Russian Revolution. So in about 1918, she was Jewish and she converted to Catholicism and married a banker. They had two daughters and in her day she was very successful. Mm. She was a best-selling author and she was writing about a book a year in the 1930s, which is amazing. And she wrote All Our Worldly Goods, which we're reading, in about 1940 and was publishing it serially in a journal called Gringoire, which I think was quite a nationalist conservative magazine or journal. And then it came out as a novel in French in 1947. In about 1940-41, her family fled Paris and went to live in a village in Burgundy and she began writing Sweet Francaise. And her idea was she wanted to write her own War and Peace. And so this was about a Paris family who flees to a village in occupied France, which was actually what she was doing at the time. So she wrote it contemporaneously and it's been described as possibly the first World War II novel because it was written as it was happening, which is quite unbelievable. Mm. And then Irene Nemirovsky was taken to Auschwitz in July 1942 and she died in August 1942. So she completed the first two novellas, which were published as Sweet Francaise much later. Yeah. Her daughter discovered the manuscript in the 1990s and she had planned to do another three parts to it, but it reads as a complete novel. And I highly recommend if you haven't read Sweet Francaise, that's how I came to learn about Irene Nemirovsky.
You've read that, yes.
Through Sweet Francaise, which has been made into a movie and it's her best known work, certainly for English readers. Sweet Francaise won the Prix Renaudot, which is the first time it's been awarded posthumously. And her daughter Denise said, "For me, the greatest joy is knowing that the book is being read. It's an extraordinary feeling to have brought my mother back to life. It shows that the Nazis did not truly succeed in killing her." So I thought that was a beautiful,
really beautiful
sentiment. Mm. And so I highly recommend Sweet Francaise. And All Our Worldly Goods is almost like a prequel or the book she wrote at a very similar time to Sweet Francaise. And but it spans an earlier time period. So it starts in the 1910s, set in a small town in northern France and also at a seaside town where they go for the summer. And it centres around two families and it spans the time from about just before World War One through to about 1942. So they reach sort of the Second World War and the central characters are Pierre and Agnes and they fall in love, but Pierre's engaged to marry Simone, who's the one who's approved by his snobbish family, and that's all set to go, but he actually breaks with his family and decides to marry Agnes. So they have a falling, the family has a falling out, and we follow Pierre and Agnes as they have children, they grow up, we follow their children's stories, and Simone remains in the novel, which I loved that. Yep. You know, she stays on and stays in touch with his family indeed. Mm. And it's this just beautiful portrait of a marriage and a family and family dynamics, which are so, so well observed. But also it gives you a history of France at that time and what it was like to live during World War One and then through the 1930s and then this dread, this sense of dread that they could tell that war was approaching. And there's a line where she says, it was like an impending death. We knew that it was coming, but we just wanted one more day, one more month before it came. And so they actually kept living as normal in lots of ways, whether it was in denial or just because what else do you do? Yeah, so it's been described as a remarkable novel, sharp portrait of France at war and during the optimistic and confused 20s and 30s by Literary Review. The Sunday Telegraph called it a great bourgeois tragedy, modest in scale but epic in scope. And A.S. Byatt, who's the author of Possession, wrote in The Guardian, a coolly crafted traditional family novel. What did you think, Amanda?
I loved reading this book, and I think I'll start by saying, knowing the history of Irène Némirovsky makes the book a lot more poignant, I think. Fact that what really amazed me about this book was that she could write something like this with such eloquence and clarity while kind of living through these cataclysmic events. And the other thing that was really fascinating as a reader is, you know, a lot of books set in and around the wars talk about the soldiers, and but this is a more of a civilian perspective. So you know the war is going on and you see the destruction that happens. Towns are destroyed, refugees are marching along the street. And so she portrays that really well. You get a real insight into what life was like. And I think for people like us living in Australia, it's a really interesting insight, because war for us has always been happening in different countries. And this shows you what it would be like if war is being fought pretty much on your doorstep and you have to evacuate at the drop of a hat and just grab a few things and go.
Hi, it's Anna here. I was just listening back to this discussion and it occurred to me that Amanda and I, talking about war in Australia, were thinking about it from a white person's perspective. And I think if you were an Aboriginal Australian listening to this, you would say war was waged in Australia at the time of white settlement or white invasion, and Aboriginal Australians did lose their lives and indeed their homes, and lost their language and culture in some cases, and their children in the stolen generations. And so I think we were discussing more recent wars like World War One and Two being fought offshore, but there's certainly another perspective to that. So I just wanted to add that in. Now back to the show.
And then the village that they lived in when they came back after the war had been totally destroyed.
Yeah, they lost their homes.
Everyone. It was all burnt and ravaged, and it's really hard to imagine. And so for these people, they just sort of pick up and get on with their lives. And so for me, that was a really fascinating look at those years, particularly in between the wars. And the other thing I loved about it was it's really at its heart a love story.
Yeah.
And it is about the two people that Anna mentioned, Pierre and Agnès. They, in the social structures of society at the time, would prevent them from being married, essentially, because Pierre was from a very wealthy family. Agnès's family was brewers, I think. So that was just not done.
Yeah. Even though they had summer houses next to each other, so they weren't that far apart in terms
Economic classes. They mixed with each other, but the thought of marriage just was not going to happen. You know, old grandfather, what's his name? Julian Ardelo, the patriarch of the family, had organised for Pierre to marry Simone, the wealthy. She was an orphan, I think, wasn't she?
An heiress.
It's more than that, because we don't want to give away the plot, but the ramifications of that go through the generations, and I think she's done that in a really clever way.
Yes, very nuanced. It shows you there's a wonderful scene where they're trying to evacuate and they're trying to sort of drive down this road, and there's obviously a huge line of cars driving, and the two families have an accident, and there's this wonderful scene of the two two of the women sitting side by side on the road. I mean, they're literally refugees at this point, and the two families are not really on good terms, but they're still making polite conversation because there's this polite society that is so ingrained into them. And she does it with a great sense of humour. She does poke fun at the snobbish elements of that bourgeois society, I think. And in the same way, when they're losing their homes, she's having a little bit of fun with that idea, even though it's very tragic, with that idea that some of these bourgeois families are so attached to their possessions.
And their linen.
And their linen, and they can't imagine letting that go.
And Anna, just back to the point I was making before about what it would be like living with, you know, impending war. There's this, I thought, for me, this really great paragraph where this is actually when the Second World War has started, and she says, outside they could hear the heavy, unmistakable murmur that rises up from towns and roads as the enemy approaches. So imagine knowing that sound. So it's a simple sentence, but it portrays so much.
Yes, and because they were near Belgium, I think.
Yeah,
and
they were right up north.
Germany occupied Belgium first. Mm. And so they really did have that sense that they were coming. They were very close in terms of proximity.
And they could hear the bombs and things at night and, you know, wondering how close are they.
Yeah, but imagine that you go to bed, but at the same time this war is being fought and it's heading your way, but then you still kind of get on with your life. No, I really loved it as well, and it's, I think one thing, as you've said, Amanda, is that if you want to get a sense of living in another place, in another time, which is what I love about fiction generally, and especially often translated fiction, taking you to another country. If you wanted to imagine being in France during the 1920s or 30s or in the wars, this is literally, you know, this is as authentic as it gets.
Yeah, really. Yeah, especially because it was written contemporaneously.
Yeah, so it does give you such an insight into the everyday life. But her writing, I just love. It's so, and it beautifully translated, I should add.
Yeah, because I agree.
Think, Sandra Smith has conveyed this through the translation, but it's really easy to read. It's very relatable, the way she writes about the family, the snobbish elements, the, you know, the young love story. It's all very relatable, and it's not fancy. The way she uses
fluid
language,
isn't it?
It's very fluid.
That's how I felt.
Yeah,
it was.
And she doesn't try to overwork it or overwrite it, but at the same time, there's a real elegance to her writing style, so that it propels you forward, but it has the sense. Sentences have a beautiful rhythm, so it's not pedestrian at all, because sometimes, you know, writing can be easy to read but also very plain and boring.
Stodgy.
And stodgy, that's right. And I loved the characters. Again, it's not overdone. She gives you a sense of them. She doesn't weigh you down with angst and, you know, endless sort of descriptions of the characters, but she just gives you some poignant moments and allows you to read between the lines, because she gives you the interesting parts and then she'll leave them and then pick them up one or two years later. So you really move along quite, as you say, fluidly. And again, the sense of place is just impeccable, the small details. And I think she was writing a biography of Chekhov at around the same time, unbelievably,
as you do.
As you do. And one reviewer suggested that she'd picked up from Chekhov the art of the small detail. And so she'll give you just little sentences about their manners or the bathing suits that the mothers are wearing.
Yeah, see, that was fascinating to me, reading about the voluminous suits, the woolen suits they were wearing to go swimming.
What they had to wear, and that would have been in the 1910s, I suppose. But and then the cars and the chauffeurs. And so there's one line later on in the 1930s maybe where they say everybody had to have a car, but you couldn't afford to have a chauffeur, and so that was that was the sort of compromise. Like, you know, you had a car but you couldn't have a chauffeur, basically. And just all those details of how they lived, and it wasn't done if you were going to dinner, even if it was in the same street, just to walk home, to be seen walking on the street after dark. And so you had to be driven home or to drive home. And so then some of the characters flout those conventions. And so, yeah, it really makes you feel like you're there. The ordinary family life, the way she captures the dynamics between the mother and the son, and between husband and wife, just little details. But then it gives you this broader history of France during the wars. And as you say, Amanda, the action, the battlefield action happens off the page, but we get such a sense of it being just all-encompassing in a way.
Sort of once a tumultuous period, isn't it?
Very tumultuous. Mm. And once the war hits, it really does affect everybody.
Yeah, regardless of your class.
Yeah, and then how people reacted. And she's very good on giving you a sense of people as a whole, you know, the whole town, how they all kind of respond, and the way there's a bit of a delayed reaction and then everybody almost on the same day decides to leave. And just, you can imagine, because we've seen that here with the COVID. You know, there was one weekend where people flocked to the supermarkets to stock up because they sensed that we're about to be
put into lockdown in Victoria.
Yeah, it's happening as we speak again. And I just found it very satisfying. And I know there was that article, it might have been A.S. Byatt's article, where they said she wanted to write her own War and Peace. And to me, it does have that satisfaction of following a family and the ebb and flow of the very small details and then the large scale war story that's going on in the background, that it did feel a bit Tolstoyan to me in the way that he gives you, in a very patient way, just this moves along more quickly.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've just finished Anna Karenina.
Yeah, he's a bit more plodding.
Yes.
And whereas she, to read Irene Nemirovsky, to me is like reading dancing. It's like someone taking you for a waltz or something.
Oh, that's a lovely way to describe it.
It's just so, as you say, fluid, it's elegant
and it makes you
stylish.
Think, I think, as well. Even though in some ways it could be read as a fairly simple tale, but because she plants so many allusions to what's happening in France at the time, it's actually a really complex tale if you think about it. And one of the points she makes is that we don't learn from history. History repeats, because after the First World War, some of the characters were saying, well,
it won't
happen again. That was the war to end all war. That no one wants to do that again. That was terrible. And then you see the Second World War creeping in.
And you sense that it's coming and you feel terrible for them, don't you?
No, she does that so well, doesn't she?
And also I liked, I mentioned it, but the comedy, that just a beautiful sense of fun to lighten up, I think, what could otherwise be quite a heartbreaking story in a way. But there is a sense of hope throughout it. And as you say, that makes it even more poignant, because we know what happened to the author in real life, you know, very soon after she wrote this. So that gives it another aspect, doesn't it? But yeah, beautiful read. I really recommend her work, and I've still got some to read. So
I definitely want to read Suite Française now.
You must. Yeah, definitely. That's just a must read.
Okay, Anna said it.
So, yes, love her work, and a great kickoff to Women in Translation Month. That's at least one that we can tick off. So that was All Our Worldly Goods by Irene Nemirovsky, translated by Sandra Smith. And coming up, Annie and I are reading The White Girl by Toni Birch, and Amanda and I are reading, is it How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi. So they're a couple that are coming up, and more. And also we're going to do, by request, our best books of the year so far.
Yes.
So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go and email us at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com. And let me think now. I am on Instagram, Litzy, and Twitter at A. Bailey Karras. And Amanda?
I am on Instagram at AmandaLHayes99.
Fabulous. We'll see you next week. Bye for now.